Here we are. Welcome. Some new faces, though familiar somehow. Faces. Have I seen
No, this
you
is
before? No?
my
First time?
second time, yeah.
Second time. Okay, right. Which was the other class that you came to?
I went to the last week mindfulness meditation.
Okay, that was with Eddie.
Yes.
Okay, great. And have you been here before? No,
No.
first time. And you've been here once before. Oh, you went to the one of the Discovering Buddhism ones on the Wednesday, yes, which I call the
Yeah,
biggies.
of
It's the in-depth class, so there are many people who join it as beginners, but yeah, it is the deep dive in. That's just how it is. It's supposed to be a beginner's course, but everything is the deep dive in with Eddie, so you just kind of get used to it. So, with me, I lead the beginner-friendly classes. So, what I do is just shove as much as I possibly can into one evening so that you get your money's worth and you've got something to really think about and chew on over the week. And so then, and Chad, you've been coming for quite a while, haven't you? Couple of years. Oh my God, I was going to say a couple of at least a few months, but okay. So yeah, it's a 10-week course, and week 7 is on demystifying death, which I was just saying before we came in. It's a really taboo, uncomfortable subject in our culture, and I'm the one to just stride on in there and break that taboo. Because actually, the more we talk about it, the less fearful it becomes. It's not like if you talk about death, you're going to somehow bring it on or anything. Actually, we can demystify it. But what we've already covered in the course is kind of getting an overview of what Buddhism is, what the refuge, what you trust in Buddhism, which is Buddha, the teachings of the Buddha, and the spiritual community, the Sangha. And how we do that is through study and meditation, and how meditation is actually about caring for the mind. So just like you get your car serviced, then you've got to service your mind. Otherwise, you just go, go, go. And then what's one of the main things that happens in our culture is burnout. And then it's really hard to recover from that. So meditation. So yeah, caring for the mind. And then the last few classes we've been discussing, well, what is the mind? What's our nature? What's the nature of the mind? And it's seen as being naturally clean and clear, but kind of contaminated with all sorts of emotional baggage, disturbing emotions, confusions, all of this that clouds the mind. But the actual nature of the mind is clear. So that's a really important thing to come back to again and again. So just like the sky is naturally clear, but it can be filled with clouds or wild weather, and there's even seasonal affective disorder, isn't it, when the clouds have been there for so long that you forget that there's sky up there. So very similar with our mind. And then we looked at a little bit about karma last week and how karmic imprints follow us from life to life on our mind stream, just like stuff in a river. What's put in upstream goes downstream, and the people downstream are like, where did this come from? So a lot of our life is like that. So what we're going to look at today, another really incredibly interesting topic about demystifying death. So we're going to have a look at how we can actually think about death so that it's useful rather than just freeze and go, oh, I don't want to know, or panic, or get depressed. How to actually think about this thing that is going to happen to all of us, so that we can actually make it useful and make the most of our life as well. We're going to have a look at the actual dying process, which is something that in Tibetan Buddhism there's a lot of understanding about, of what happens when we die and what happens next. So from a Buddhist point of view, the actual process series of events and what to do with a dead Buddhist. So how to prepare so that we're ready and so that we can help instead of be a hindrance, be a help when someone else around us dies or even when our pets get sick and die, which can often be even more traumatic than human beings. So how to actually be able to help ourselves and others. One of the reasons why we talk about, why we have this class also is because many times I'll hear people say, and I've said it myself, oh, if I die, I'd want blah, 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 blah. And it's this little slip of the tongue. It's like, if? What do you mean if? There's no if. So it kind of shows that we intellectually, we know it's going to happen, but emotionally, we may not be ready. There's also a lot of uncertainty. And then how on earth do you even talk about it? So Eddie, who leads the Wednesday night classes, Discovering Buddhism, you know, he's just his whole passion in life is the Dharma. So if you ever invite him to a party, he's going to end up talking about either emptiness and the nature of the mind or death. That's it. So it can either be a real conversation stopper, or there's always one other person at the party who's really happy to talk about death all night. So they'll be there. So let's set our motivation for the evening. So let's adjust our posture and then adjust our mind. So the posture, imagine that you have a fine thread of light running through your body from the base of your spine, just in front of your spine, and coming out the crown of your head, and feel as if it's being pulled upwards, just gently, so that your posture will naturally extend. Feel as if all the weight of your body is being supported from your crown by this thread of light. And once your spine is relatively straight, then let your shoulders drop and release any tension from the neck and the shoulders. And have your head just slightly tilted forward, chin tucked in, jaw relaxed, tongue on the upper palate behind the top teeth. And relax all of the tension that's often held around the eyes, the frown lines, the forehead. Let your eyes just be lightly closed or even with a bit of light coming in. And just let your attention rest on the breath, just being aware of the rising and falling of the breath. So we can think of the reasons that brought us here tonight. They must have been important enough to make the effort to get here and find a place. So bring all of those reasons and questions to mind. We can reflect that, as they say, what's certain in life is death and taxes. We sometimes prepare for one and we seldom prepare for the other. Even though it's something that will happen to us all. And actually, from a Buddhist perspective, it can be a profound stepping stone to liberation and enlightenment. So we can set our motivation to find out about this universal experience and use it to take the very essence of this life, make the very most of the life that we have. And to be able to be of the best help to ourselves and others. And so, with this developing courage and understanding, then we'll be able to be of help in the world, especially with a topic that's often frightening for people. So, with this altruistic intention, then take a deep breath in through the nose, out through the mouth. Right. So, demystifying death, why do we even have to think about it? Well, part of it is if we're already a bit spooked now, that's an indication that we're not ready. And it's better to know now that we're not ready or that we've got unresolved things or fears or uncertainties. It's better to face it now while we've got the leisure and the opportunity. So, this is a little bit from Gelug Rinpoche, Good Life, Good Death, which is a really nice little book. And it's just a little introduction, sets the scene in a very nice way. And he says, we all have this idea, I won't die today. Everyone thinks like this, including people on their deathbed. We visit someone at the hospital, we all know that they're dying, they know it too. But still, they talk about what they'll do next week. It's important to remember this. Why? Because our troubles come unexpectedly, particularly death. You go to see a doctor, and the doctor says, you're fine. You get into your car, then you have a crash and die. It can happen. This is to remind people that this life is wonderful, but there are limitations. Before those limitations take over, achieve what you want to achieve. Do something while you are able to. Right now, everything is wonderful, happy, beautiful, enjoyable, but that well-being is temporary. It could change any minute. Anything can go wrong at any moment. So, this talk of death or impermanence is not meant to make you afraid. The whole purpose of it is for you to have compassion for yourself and to travel well. So, in a way, how we can make our life meaningful now is by putting in the in that context of that our death is going to come, and it's better to keep that in mind than to just think we have forever. Otherwise, it is so easy to just, I don't know, waste all that time that I spend on TV or scrolling or whatever. And it's like, what did I do with the day? And then the older friends that I have who somehow think that death's going to come to them quicker than it does to me, they like making much more use of their time and actually a little less stressed than me, too. So often we get to the end of our life. And we have regrets. People get to the end of their life, and there's a lot of bitterness and regrets, and it can be quite distressing because you get towards the end of your life and you think, I wish I had done things differently. And many of those things are, for instance, keeping secrets, keeping a secret from your family, say that you're gay or that you're autistic or something like that, and then trying to be to others this kind of presentation. And then you get towards the end of your life and you just go, what a waste of time. Why wasn't I authentic? Why did I put this mask and this kind of facade up instead of being authentically me and, sharing what's authentic with others? Or we might spend a whole lot of time just working in jobs that we hate because we think it's important to, for whatever reasons. Or you might spend a whole lot of time just hating your parents, which is another thing that happens. And then they die, or you get to the end of your life and nothing's resolved. And you spent the whole time hating on people. And that just harms us. So if we think about our death now, we will make our life meaningful now. We'll be able to die without regrets. And we'll be able to face our death without fear. And I've met people like this that have been ready to go and have been happy with how they led their life, that have thought, I've just given it my absolute all and I've tried to be good and I have no regrets and didn't necessarily work out, but they're ready. They feel calm in themselves. Not necessarily religious people, but it's possible to do this. So, even though intellectually we know we're going to die, we certainly haven't realized it yet. And so, this is the formula. Now is the time to meditate on impermanence and death and let yourself feel fear and anxiety and look at it and spend the time looking at it. Because then, later on, when it's actually happening, you'll be able to have faith, confidence. You know what's going to happen. You feel okay, and you'll be able to die with a calm mind. So, I've got to say, so many times I see it the other way around. People are like, la 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 la, don't want to talk about it. And then I get the phone calls, because I've been at Langley Trauma Centre for like almost 30 years now. I get the phone calls, the panicked phone calls of either a family member is dying or in hospital. What do I do? What do I do? Or a pet is dying. And, it's just so hard to witness this and feel so helpless about it. And it's really hard then to start preparing because it's already happening. And I can't say, well, you should have come to that demystifying death class, hey. So before we go into that, a little bit more. Any questions or comments? How are you going? Often in this class, someone comes along and someone's just recently died. Is that, or it's a really close to the bone kind of thing?
Yeah.
No? Yeah. Right. And you probably wouldn't have come.
I'm keen to understand a bit more.
Well, I just done on Saturday with our little family WhatsApp chat. My father's in Melbourne and his wife was saying he woke up, he couldn't breathe, his blue lips, blue fingers, should I call the ambulance and all these other things. And so all of the adult children are like, are you insane? Of course. Anyway, so and I was on my way to a concert when I got all of those messages. So all the way through the concert, I basically wrote my father's eulogy because you're sitting there and it's playing through my mind. And so I'm going through all the things and what it was like growing up with him and things like this. Anyway, by the end of the day, it turns out that actually his wife had posted all the things that she'd Googled to watch out for, not the things that were actually happening. So everyone had this big panic. But it was a really good exercise because it showed nobody was ready. So each time it's like you get to have the conversation with the family a little bit more because no one has the conversation. What do you want to happen? Where do you want to die? At home or in the hospital? Do you even want to call the ambulance? All of those things. So it was good. The conversation inched forward a little bit. Any other questions or comments as we go? Memento moris, they're the little, yes. So that's what when I was 18, I got a little skull tattoo and I wanted it to look like a nightclub stamp. And I thought it was like going to be my spiritual thermometer that if I ever looked at it and didn't like it, I'd know to be worried. So before we even go into what happens during death, we've got to look at actually what is death exactly anyway, because definitions are everything, and what death isn't just a sudden thing. It's actually a process. So it's a progressive loss of physical, sensory, and mental functions as our body slowly closes down. And so it's a process. And somewhere along in that process, the breath stops. But if you've ever watched Bondi Rescue, you know, the lifesaver ones, and they go into the surf and they get people out of the surf and they're not breathing, but they resuscitate them. So, you know, there's a line, isn't there, that you, a spectrum where the breath ceases, there's that when the brain, I think then the heart stops, then the brain stops. And quite along that way, you can bring people back. So you can't say, oh, you're dead when you stop breathing, because you can be revived. You also, just because your heart stops, it can be started again. So there's this set, kind of closing down from the breath ceasing, brain, the heart, the circuitry, the nervous system takes about 3 days to stop slowly, you know, the circulatory system of the blood. So then, when what would you say death is? How do you know? There's got to be a point. And see, the thing is that there isn't a set point. So legally, it's actually when the doctors can do no more, when they go, that's it, we've tried. So it's going to be different. If you're in the outback and all you've got is a little first aid kit and someone's trying to revive you, when they call you as dead, then it's going to be very different from if you're in a hospital with all of the machines. So there's no set point. It really depends. From a Buddhist point of view, what death is when body and mind separate. Yes, that's right. But the connection isn't severed. So once the connection's severed, that's it. You can't shove it back in again. There's no Frankenstein happening here. But yeah, that's right. So actually, how can you tell when body and mind have separated? And it's not that just the mind is like on an elastic going out and coming back again, which is happens. Yeah. And so from the Buddhist understanding, we'll be able to see as we go through tonight. I like this analogy. We can think of it as it's a universal process, and just like birth is a universal process, but each birth is completely unique. So same thing, death, body and mind separate, but how we go through that process is it's individual, it's quite unique. So here's a little thing from His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Thupten Chodron from the Foundation of Buddhist Practice. And so they say, if our lives are centered primarily around the eight worldly concerns, our mind becomes familiar with non-virtues and afflictions. While dying, attachment to self arises, and wanting security and not suffering, we cling to what is familiar, our body, mind, and so forth. Then, fearing that we'll cease to exist at death, we crave another body. So that's kind of ordinarily what happens. In contrast to this panicked fear, if while we're alive, we generate a wise fear of death, we'll be able to set our priorities wisely and make our lives meaningful. The wise fear is aware of the danger of destructive karma ripening at the time of death and propelling us to an unfortunate rebirth. It sharpens our mindfulness, motivates us to practice virtue, and enables us to prevent that danger. So this fear is similar to the mental state when we merge our car into highway traffic. Aware of the possibility of having an accident, we are cautious, which prevents an accident. Wise fear inspires us to set clear priorities so that we make our life meaningful and do not waste it on unimportant activities. Our life becomes very vibrant and vital as we live each moment fully, aware that the only time we can practice the Dharma is now. And due to practicing diligently, we'll be free of fear or regret at the time of death. So this is how we can think about death. And for ages, I thought, It's a called a 9-point death contemplation. So the three main points: death is certain, the time of death is uncertain, and only Dharma can help. So with the one of death is certain, this is where we can think, well, has anyone been able to stop death? Not ever. You can't bribe death. It doesn't matter if you're wealthy or not. It's just gonna happen to everybody. However, it doesn't stop a whole lot of people spending heaps of money trying to develop those genes that stop you aging and all of that kind of thing. Not only that, that we can't extend our lifespan, that as we live, our life's just getting shorter and shorter. And there was a great app for that called Death Clock, where you put it on your phone and it's on the open screen of your phone, and you put in your age and gender and your diet and all those kinds of things, and it calculates your probability of how long you're going to live for. And then you put in your birth date, and then it just counts down. And so it's really confronting, because it's like second by second, you're just like, oh, what? So effective. So, yeah, it's just getting shorter and shorter. And, you know, think about it. Of how many billion people in the world right now, in 100 years, every single one of us will be dead. It'll be a whole bunch, new bunch. The third point of this one is that we're going to die even if we're not ready. And this is the one that got me, that you can't just go, hang on a second, I just want to finish this. It's going to happen when we're in the middle of something. So we've got to make sure that the things that we're doing that we're going to be in the middle of are worth it. So contemplating that death is certain, it's an absolute certainty, there's a conclusion that we come to, which is, therefore, I've got to follow a spiritual path, meaning something that's really meaningful, that's not just the worldly concerns of money and family and status and wealth, because what use are they? It's got to be something with meaning. So there's the contemplation, and there's then the conclusion that we come to. And this is the thing that I missed for many, many years. I just go, death is certain, and then I just freeze. And I just shut down and go, well, that's it. I don't want to think about this anymore. But it's to lead us to a conclusion. Therefore, we've got to follow a spiritual path. If all we have is a materialistic path, then at the time of our death, it's all over. It's quite a narrow kind of thing. The second one is, even though death is certain, the time of death is uncertain. We don't know when it's going to happen. A couple of Eurovisions ago, Madonna had a song, and it was a great song. It was, not everyone is going to the future. So our lifespan, it's not fixed. Even though we kind of expect older people to die first and younger people last, doesn't work out that way. So lifespan's not fixed. There are many things that can kill us. There's more chance of dying than living. All the things that sustain life can actually kill us as well. So food, you can get food poisoning. Water, you can die from floods. The sun, you can get cancer, all of these things. Body's really fragile. So because the body is fragile and because we don't know what's coming, the conclusion is, therefore, I've got to follow the Dharma or a spiritual path from this moment on, because we don't know when death's coming. We've got to do something meaningful from this moment, not next year, because we don't know if we'll have a next year. And this whole thing of putting everything off, I'll be happy when I retire, or I'll be happy when this, or I'll be happy when that, that never comes. Actually, this is it. So some kind of inner path, meaning from this moment on, not when I have more time later. And the third part, at the time of death, only Dharma can help, or only a spiritual path can help. or only an inner journey can help, because our wealth can't help, our friends can't help, and our body can't help. So even though we spend most of our time trying to accumulate wealth, there's a Scottish saying, a shroud has no pockets. And, you know, we accumulate all of this. In the end, all of that stuff that we've accumulated, it's just a cause for our family to fight. Our friends can't help. Our near and dear who would do anything to help us, they can't. We all have to go through this process ourselves. Even though people want to be able to help us, when death comes, they can't do it for us. And our body can't help, because that's when our body starts breaking down and not working anymore. So this kind of wonderful tool or machine for living stops working, kind of betrays us in a way. So the conclusion for this is, therefore, so from the point of view, we'd say I must only follow the Dharma. So what it means actually is that, therefore, the main path that you follow should be an inner path, not a materialistic one, not following wealth or fame, because none of that will carry on. So the main thing, the main path that we have should be the Dharma, our inner journey, because that's the actual thing that will help us. So these are like a very fine balancing act for putting our life into perspective by recognizing the limitations. And I've found personally that if I am thinking about this, I just stop having arguments with people. It's the thing that stops you arguing, because really the getting in a funk, having the sulks or arguing with someone, you do it because you think there's going to be a tomorrow where you'll be able to make up, where it's going to be better. But many times, it's often in the movies, isn't it, where people will say someone will die an untimely death, and the relatives that are there are like, the last thing we said was cross words. Why does that happen? Because we just assume there's going to be a tomorrow. And if we don't assume that, then we're just going to focus on the actual positive relationships that we have. That will become the most important. What do you reckon about that? Yeah, it's mostly it's the meditation for ourselves, how to contemplate our mortality now, so that it's useful, so that we are galvanized to make the most of this life and not have regrets.
Like,
yeah,
about
yeah.
It, like,
no, no. But I think if you get familiar with these points and comfortable to look at them, then kind of the rule of thumb is to play it by ear. So what the rest of your family is willing to talk about, then you will have the confidence and the open-heartedness to be there, to be ready. Yeah, because it's no good pushing it on people, but often it's either the oldies or the kids. The kids will have a question, and then, again, you play it by what their question is, you just answer that question. But to be able to do so without feeling immensely uncomfortable or put on the spot, we have to do this ourselves and become familiar and comfortable about it. Yeah, so near-death experiences are kind of incredibly useful in that way, because often it changes people's life, doesn't it? They go, I'm not living my life how it was before, because, you know, it was wasted. Those things don't matter at all. This is what matters, and I wasn't spending any time on this. So this meditation is to have a near-death experience like that without having to have the near-death experience. So this is one to come back to over your morning coffee often until you're comfortable with it. Then we've got the actual death process. What happens during the dying process. And this is something that the Buddhist practitioners, especially in the Tibetan tradition, are very knowledgeable about. So the information comes from being able to access really subtle states of mind in meditation. It comes from then observation of people who are dying, because, you know, a lot of the monks and nuns and priests, lamas, that's their job, is to be there at death to make sure that you have a good, calm death. But also then memories from not necessarily past lives, but remembering back through past experiences. So it's a whole collection in this tradition. Right, so this is from The Perfect Mirror, Venerable Gyatso. Death is the gradual disassociation of the subtle wind and mind from the body. So the subtle energy and mind from the body. It's like going to sleep, but the mind goes all the way to the clear light and then separates from the body. The process of dying occurs in 8 stages over a variable period of time, as the gross mind begins to withdraw from the gross body. So we've got 2 main stages. The first 4 stages of the dying process are from the point of view of, say, of us dying, are experiences of kind of visions. So they're not visions like you see with your eyes. They're more like experiences. An experience of a mirage, smoke, fireflies, and the flickering flame. And so if we become aware of these, then when it's actually happening to us, it's like we'll have a map and we'll know where we're going. So it really is like navigating the death process. So just like when you came to Lugri Tumpa Centre tonight, from wherever you came from, you figured out, oh, yeah, this is where I've got to end up, and you have a few landmarks along the way. And as you're getting here, you see the landmark and go, yep, I'm on the right track. there's the next one, and then you arrive. So it's good to have a map and know. So this is the internal map of the process. And so as we go through, we have various losses of, as the body's shutting down, loss of physical power, loss of feelings and emotions, loss of discrimination, loss of volitions or thinking. And then that's when the breathing stops. And from a Buddhist point of view, you're only halfway there. So that's the coarse body and mind separating and shutting down. But the process continues in a more subtle way. So the next 4 are what's called white appearance, red increase, black near attainment, and the clear light of death. So these are non-conceptual experiences. So they're post-conceptual, post-verbal, because all of those kind of things to do with the senses have already shut down. So the breathing might have stopped, but the consciousness is still there. So if you've ever been with anyone who's dying, and I've only been with a couple of people who are dying, the main person, my mother, so she was who started Lugri Tumpa Centre. And so she was a practicing Buddhist for 20-odd years or so. And so when she got her diagnosis of cancer and however many months to live, she was both upset but also really curious. What's going to happen? All of this study that I've done, like, is it going to pan out like how I was expecting? And so I was there, and we were able to verify a lot of these things going through the experience. So here are the first one, the mirage vision. So Inta, my mother, she said maybe a year before she died, she had dreams of, she said it's like the stars in the daytime melting in the sky. Really beautiful. So it's this mirage kind of thing. Or this is a photo of the water going down the glass at the Victoria Gallery, National Gallery. So this mirage, this kind of shimmery things where things get a bit melty. So in the dying process, this inner vision, like a silvery blue mirage or water, it can happen coming and going for up to a year before you die. But then in the actual dying process, once this vision happens, it might take a few hours or a few days. And so when this vision's happening, what's happening from the point of view of the person dying is that your limbs become weak. And it's also where it's difficult to move your eyes. So all of that, how they have in the movies where your eyes tend to kind of roll upwards, that's one of the signs. So a lot of people who are nurses, they'll go, they've only got a few hours left. They'll see it as a sign. But the internal vision, our experience of it, is that of things just beginning to melt and get shimmery. So when that happens, then you can recognize it and know. I can also say that if you've been really, really sick with fever or delirium, this will happen as well. It happened to me a couple of times, gone into it and come back out again, definitely at death's door. So then the next vision or experience is the smoke vision. And so that is where you feel like you're in a smoke-filled room. And because your senses and everything are slowly shutting down, what weakens is a sense of feeling. So feelings of pain or pleasure go. Feelings of happiness or sad, they go. So this is really interesting because from the point of view of the person dying, things are falling away. It's getting much simpler and less stressed in a way. From the point of view of if you're watching somebody dying, dying looks, it's a messy thing. It's this struggle, this fight to breathe. It's an epic life and death battle. So it might look like the person is struggling, but actually the inner experience is quite different, is things falling away. And a lot of the emotional distress just falling away, like the layers. So that's when the mouth gets dry. And so often the nurses will say, you know, you'll suck on a piece of ice or something like that. Then a vision of like fireflies. And the experience of that is that you stop being able to recognize faces or remember names. So that the discrimination between this and that, this person and that person starts going. Maybe you're just now recognizing humans, but the fine discriminations, they're falling away. And your breathing's becoming weak. So the inhalation, the breathing in is weak and the breathing out is long. And so often what can happen at this stage is that the relatives are around and whoever's dying gets you mixed up, calls you by the wrong name. And it can be really devastating when that happens, or they can't remember who you are. So don't take that personally. It's not a bad thing. It's just that the discriminating facility is falling away. Then the vision of a flickering flame, often they say like a light down the bottom of a well. And that's where you can't move the limbs anymore and where the purpose of work in this life is forgotten. So this kind of thing, when especially with old people, when they're ready to go, the whole, you know, they can't be bothered thinking about what's happening in the day or whatever. They're just like they're over it. So this is where the whole purpose of this life, purpose of work in this life is forgotten. And the senses of touch and taste stop, and then the breathing stops. So when my mother was dying, it was like this uphill battle, each breath in and out, oh, my God. And then breathed in, breathed out, and that was it. And then it was like, oh, relief, quiet. So she's still there, but the battle was finishing. And because she died at home, then we let her be there undisturbed. All you have to do is call a doctor. The doctor will certify that the breath has stopped, the person has died, but you can leave the body there to just continue through the rest of the process. And so the thoughts, the feelings, the sensations, all of that's finished, but the consciousness is still there in a much more subtle level. So up until this point, it can actually be reversed. So some people are really, really sick, might go through, see some of these visions, and then come back out again. And the whole process could take a few hours or could take a few days. So that's why from the Buddhist point of view, they say to leave the body for like 2 or 3 days if possible. And then there are signs to be able to tell if the consciousness is left or not. So then we've got the next four, the much more subtle visions or experiences, so that what's called white appearance. So they say it's like an empty sky filled with the light of a full moon. Again, it's not with the eyes because there's no verbal, there's no discrimination or language there anymore. It's just an experience. Pre-instinctual, and the global experiences of name and thought or the deep I dissolves. So it's just like bare experience. Then what's called red increase, which is a brighter inner vision, like a clear empty sky filled with the rays of a red sunset. Then a vision of total darkness, without any form at all, and like a momentary loss of consciousness, complete loss of consciousness. And then the most subtle consciousness that when we talked about in the class of the mind, that's there innate but latent, because everything else has fallen away, the most subtle consciousness now becomes apparent, which is called the clear light. Consciousness, the clear light at the time of death. And so that's like the light at the sky at dawn, which is a very subtle thing. And so if you've had the leisure to die at your own pace, like die at home, undisturbed, you can stay in this clear light for hours and possibly days. So the consciousness is still connected with the body. So when my mother was dying, you know, we were going through and I could recognize some of these stages, and I could recognize what stage she was in with her breathing and her eyes, and then when she stopped being able to communicate, when she stopped breathing, and then I wondered, would I be able to tell? Is the consciousness there or not? And I can assure you that it is a no-brainer. You can tell, because there's the person there, it's just that they're not breathing, but there's clearly a person there. And I wondered, would I be able to tell when the consciousness had left? And after, it was, I think, about 2.5 days with Inter, I went into the room and now it was just like a shell, just a corpse. No person there. It was really clear. And I've heard other people say that too, when they've been taken to see dear George or whoever it was, and they go, here he is, here's your husband. And they're like, that's not my husband, that's a shell. My husband's not there. You will know, but there are signs. So one of the signs is that a little bit of blood comes out of the nose. So I wondered, would that happen with Inter? Actually, a little bit of blood came out of her mouth rather than her nose. And yeah, suddenly it was like any of the life force was just gone. And I've also seen the same with pets as well. You can tell if the consciousness is there or if it's now just a corpse. So from a Buddhist point of view, in this clear light of death, that's the time where you do the most subtle meditation, because all of the distractions of having a physical form and all of the emotional baggage of this life, it's all gone. What's left is your innate clear mind. And so that's where you can meditate on the nature of your mind. You can burn up all of the delusions and the afflictions, and you stay in that clear light for as long as possible. And so my mother, about maybe two and a half days, I think. Eddie's wife, Tash, who died many years ago, I think was maybe just like a few hours. So it depends a lot on what kind of illness the person has died from and a whole lot of other factors. One of the other things that you can do, it's closely associated with rigor mortis. So rigor mortis usually travels through the body and then back out again. And so when Inta died and she stopped breathing, what was really weird, it's going to sound a bit kind of strange, but I was looking at her and her hand looked dead, but her arm looked alive. And it was like the energy was withdrawing. And so, and a similar thing happens with rigor mortis. So you could see the energy withdrawing, and we'd also put to see the heat. And so the arm would be cold, but the heat would still be around the heart. So you can tell ways like that as well. Once rigor mortis has set in and then gone, that's pretty much, it's just parallel with the consciousness leaving. So that was the other thing, like everyone was freaking out, like, oh no, we're going to have this corpse in the house, and like it's going to smell. And I'm like, chill. What's the worst that could happen? We have to buy a new mattress. It's not like this is a gory horror movie. And so what happens, of course, is that while the consciousness is there, the body is not decomposing. Once the consciousness leaves, then it's finished. Then that moment the body starts decomposing. So it's a lot simpler than we kind of realize. I think also nurses, palliative care nurses, they can tell they're gone now, it's okay. The good thing about palliative care is that you've got the time to be able to sit with the body and wait for this to happen. So here from His Holiness says, at this clear light of death, now the subtlest mind, the fundamental innate clear light mind manifests. This is the actual moment of death. Although the subtlest wind mind is still present in the body, and a well-trained practitioner will meditate on the wisdom realizing emptiness. There is no rigor mortis, and there may be a slight sense of heat if we hold our hand above the person's heart chakra at the center of the chest. During this time, the relationship between the body and mind has not been severed, and the body does not decay. So it's better to avoid touching or moving the body at this time. So does that accord with anybody's experience? Any other? That's right. So the kids will know. He's gone now. Yeah. Yeah. It's something that all we need is to have that connection with the person, maybe even not that, just to be attentive. Yeah. Yeah. And, the Maori way, it's really lovely, isn't it, to be accompanied out with all of this love and real appreciation and rejoicing of that person's life. It's really heartfelt, and it can have a wonderful kind of onward journey. Yeah, really.
I do think.
Yeah, it's a very impoverished kind of culture that we have like that, the materialistic one, without this space to go through this natural process that is profound and meaningful. And I kind of think about, you know, every now and again you hear of, say, teenage girls that freak out. They think they're dying of cancer or something, but it turns out that they were actually pregnant and they didn't know, and they gave birth in the toilets at school. And it's like, and this happens. It happens in our modern society in Australia. And you go, how can this be in this day and age that you can be pregnant and give birth and not know what's happening? So I take that and I go, but that's how we are with death. It happens to everybody, and we're like that. We don't even know until it's upon us because we have no education and all those taboos. Just like if you have no sex education and all those taboos, what hope do you have? You're terrified. So, yeah, there's a big lack in our Western culture for that. And it does, because if we're quite sheltered from death. Other cultures, you know, death happens all over the place, like it's there in your face, but we're really sheltered from it. So when it happens, it's deeply shocking. Yeah.
The opening.
Yeah, so, and you can thank your nan for that. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've got a friend who her first experience of anything to do with death was when she was just turning 30 and her dog died, and that was her first experience, because she'd even been sheltered from pets dying when you're a kid. She was so unprepared and so devastated, and it's because we just haven't had the chance to become familiar with this thing that's, you know, it's there all the time. So how to prepare for our own death, how to actually make sure that that we don't get caught out, that we don't get traumatized and have all of that energy kind of sapped from us. No, so any palliative care is, I mean, it's really good because the nurses there are there to make a natural transition be as calm as possible. Whereas if you're in a hospital, their whole thing is to keep you alive no matter what. So those two approaches are really different. As to what to do with a dead Buddhist, or how to die as a Buddhist, no, you probably want to have some Dharma buddies, some monks or nuns or Dharma practitioners there to guide you, because the nurses won't. They'll just make sure that you're comfortable and not in pain, and, you know. So that's actually, Adrian, what we'll have a look at now. So preparing for our own death, contemplate death and impermanence often over your cornflakes at the beginning of the day. It'll change what you do with the day. Practice the sequence of visions of this dying process so you know, so you can navigate your way there and back. So that when it happens, you'll go, ah, I recognize. There are many prayers and pujas on the FPMT website that you can do. You can get the monks and nuns at Copan to say prayers. So people do this often, even if you're just ill, going through obstacles. As a Buddhist, you would do various practices like retake all of your vows so that you die with squeaky, clean, wonderful, new, fresh vows. Prepare your will and enjoy giving your stuff away. So this is another thing really telling. You ask a bunch of Buddhists, how many of you have your will? And it's not everybody does. It's like, this is the number one thing. So hands up, who's got a will? But it needs changing, I know. That's right. Yeah, so ironically, I rang up the whatever it is, the people that do the will for free, and they said, oh, we can give you an appointment in 6 months. And I'm like, well, you hope I don't die before then. What? But then they rang me. They had a cancellation, and they rang me, and I got in a week later, which is like, phew, because all those people, I'm not friends with them anymore. So, you know, what a change of things. Enjoy giving your stuff away rather than clinging to it now and then having that just drag you back. it's much more fun to start giving it away while you're alive. And in fact, it's the only way that you can make sure that anybody gets that stuff is if you give it to them while you're alive. Otherwise, you end up like a little mini version of the Gina Rinehart family, isn't it? Talk to your family and let them know what you want to happen. Have an idea of, you know, the circumstances to call an ambulance or not, what kind of palliative care, whether you want to make organ donations. So it's hard to broach this topic. So there are a couple of kind of international movements that are really interesting with this. One's called Death Cafe, that's really popular, that you just go and meet at some cafe and someone kind of is the moderator. And there's a whole other movement called Death Over Dinner. And that's an international website as well. So they're really skilled ways of being able to start the conversation if it's really hard to have the conversation with your folks. It's good to arrange whatever advanced health directives. It's better to do that now while you're in able body and mind than when you're sick or when you had an accident, you're in the hospital and everyone's running around trying to figure out what did you want to happen. That is the worst time to try and figure this stuff out. And yes, arrange for a Dharma friend to be with you and help you prepare. So when we are facing our own death, or even when we're facing just sickness, some kind of illness or trauma, the thing is to just run towards the Dharma. Run towards your spiritual path, not away from it. So that's to help us get ready. There are some things that we can do to help others, because we're going to be the ones in our friendship circle. It's going to be us that's going to be the sane one, or the one that's going to help, that people are going to rely on. Like everybody else falls apart, it's going to be us. So we also need to know how to keep it together. But before we do that, I wanted to do a little reflection and also just ask, what else? Anything else? Any other? Yeah, organ donations, there's a huge, big discussion about this. So Lama Zopa Rinpoche over here on the throne says, no, don't do organ donations, because what you want is to be able to leave the body for 2 or 3 days and meditate in the clear light. So as a Buddhist practitioner, yes, that's what you'd want to do. But also at the same time, I've put yes for organ donations, because if I have an untimely death and I'm hit by a bus or whatever and there is some useful bit, then I want it to be useful. So it's, again, it's going to depend on the circumstances. Also, I'm not so sure, would I be able to meditate in the clear light for 2 or 3 days? So the thing is to do with your intention. And if you want to offer your body to others, that is an altruistic motivation. If that's what you want to do, then do it. Because one of the things Rinpoche said, why not to do organ donations, is because when they come to take the organs, you have this habitual self-grasping at the body as me. And if you're not aware of that, that just instinctually, you know, kicks in and you don't want to let it go. But if in your mind you think this is an amazing way, I haven't been able to give my body in my life, but now I can in my death, and that's what you want, it'll turn out okay. So one of our members here, her daughter was over in Ireland and had an untimely death. I think she was like 22 years old. But she somehow, before going overseas, had done all of this, put, I want to do organ donations, and she'd got it all organised. And it's really hard to do that in, or it was at that time in Ireland, Catholic country, like was super, super tricky. And yet, so Maureen went over, and the thing that that really, she said, really comforted her was that there were like 35 people that benefited from her daughter's body. So, you know, it's to do with intention. Yeah. Let's do a really nice reflection. And this is a meditation actually that you can do with anybody, especially someone who's frightened of death. So straighten your spine, bring your mind inward. Feel the air as you breathe in and out. His Holiness the Dalai Lama often quotes this beautiful verse, just like space and the great elements such as earth, water, fire and air, may I always support the lives of all boundless creatures. So we can dedicate the four elements of our body to the happiness of all beings, becoming the very foundation of life for countless beings. So imagine first that all of your flesh and bones dissolves into the earth element and your body becomes stable ground that supports life. It becomes fields and crops, parks and forests, gold and jewels and precious minerals. Your earth element becoming the very earth. Imagine your eyes become the sun and the moon, illuminating and guiding beings. Your flesh becomes all the food everywhere, nourishing and delicious. Your skin becomes clothing, soft bedding, fur and feathers that keep beings warm. And now imagine your blood dissolving into the water element, nourishing all life, flooding rice paddies, flowing through canals, watering flowers, quenching thirst. Imagine all the heat of your body merges with the fire element, providing warmth, light, the power to cook, the power to travel. And imagine that your breath becomes air, the wind element itself. Breath is life. Allow yourself to be breathed in by all beings, bringing oxygen to every cell of everybody. In this way, your body's four elements become like nectar to sentient beings. And into this nectar flows the transcendental wisdom from all the Buddhas. And this nectar wisdom nourishes all beings, fulfilling their wishes and bringing them ultimate happiness. Having offered your body to all beings, your body no longer exists, only the mind remains, with no inherent existence of its own. Rest attention on its true nature, open, empty, clear, and luminous. And finally, dedicate the merit that you may actually use the elemental forces of body and mind to benefit all beings everywhere. And you can gently bring your focus back to the room. Did you like the meditation? It's a really, really lovely one to do, especially if people are clinging to life, not ready to let go, frightened of death. It's such a beautiful way to just release naturally. And yeah, you don't have to be religious. So then, how to help the dying person? So two main things: help them keep a happy mind and to keep a calm environment. Because really what determines where we end up next, what happens afterwards, is determined by the state of our mind. So we want to be able to have a happy mind, a calm death. So one of the main things, of course, relax, talking about death won't bring it on. So my folks, my father and his wife, several months ago, they got the call from the doctor. He was in hospital and the doctor's like, you have to have a conversation with the whole family. What do you want to happen? And so Jill's saying, oh, well, I've got to talk to the various grown-up adult children. I'll be able to get back to it in a few days. And the surgeon's like, you've got 2 hours. She's, what? So that was the beginning of the conversation. And so since then, there's been a little bit more talk. Luckily, he didn't die and we were able to, get through a few of the questions. One way to really think about this is, and this is what Geshe Tashi Tsering told me, is to think that it's not a permanent separation. It's like going away on a long overseas trip. Because from a Buddhist point of view, we've had past lives, we've got future lives, we have this connection. Geshe-la basically just whacked me on the shoulder and said, of course you'll meet again. Like, there's the connection there. Just like when you go to see someone off at the airport, they're going off to Germany or something, you don't like hold on to their ankles and, no, don't leave me, don't go. Even if you don't want them to go, you just make sure they have everything. Do you have everything that you need? You've got this, you've got your passport, you've got your snacks, you're ready, you've got your guidebook, you know the whatever language, and then you go, it'll be great, it'll be fantastic, off you go, have an excellent time. Even though you're like, whoa. Once they're on the plane, then you all can go, oh, I didn't want them to go. But, you know, this is the thing. It's like a great big overseas journey. So Kerry, one of our members, when her mother was dying, she really took this on board, and there was little kids around and everything too. So what her mother did was get this little case together and called it her happy rebirth day. And so the kids put all the special things into the case for her onward journey. So that way they got used to the fact that she was going to die and she'll be gone soon, and they got to participate in their own way. It was really lovely. Help them arrange their worldly affairs, give away belongings, help resolve grudges. And if you can't resolve the grudge, then to at least just confess and purify in whatever way. To release those things. And nurses tell me that a lot of times they're the ones that people die by themselves in the hospital and they tell the nurse, oh, this thing I did, I feel really bad about it. And the nurse, you know, it's not their job, but they'll say, it's okay, tell me more, let it out, it's all right. Yeah, don't cling or beg them not to die, it's going to happen. So the thing is to encourage them. And like you were saying, whichever religion someone is, don't try and turn them into a Buddhist or whatever. It's whatever their refuge is. You go with that. So if they're a Christian, you reconnect them with their refuge of God or Jesus or the saints or whatever it is, with hymns, Christian prayers, God loves you, you are loved, you'll be fine, all of that kind of thing. And if they're not religious, don't shove religion down their throat. So if they're not religious, then things like poetry, often like Sufi poetry or Zen poetry, really nice calming music. So something to really create this internal atmosphere. Once the breathing is stopped, then you can go back to saying your Buddhist prayers, because Buddhist, not Buddhist, is not going to matter by that stage. There isn't that distinction anymore. So then you revert back to your own refuge. But while they're going through the process, you connect them with theirs. And then keep a calm environment. Rejoice at their life and all of their qualities. So that's the time when to, especially when there's all the relatives waiting in the waiting room feeling like they have no control over anything and they don't know what to do, and everyone's just sitting there just waiting, stressed. So that's when you start thinking about the good things about that person and talking about their good qualities and the good things that they've done. It can really help them. It's like putting fuel into into the onward journey. Turn off any invasive drips and don't fuss. So let the medical practitioners stop trying to do everything possible to keep the person alive if they're going through this natural process. And if you're a Buddhist, you'd be singing mantras really nicely and slowly, or having them play in the background so that it helps with the vibe, the whole tone. That's just a general kind of way of, and you can do this, you can act through this, whether you feel ready or not. You can be the one that goes, it's going to be okay. I've done that. People have called Long Reach Humper Centre and I've gone to the hospital and I'm like, I have no idea what's going on here. But what people need is someone who's calm and who's there to help. So we can all do that. Now, Pauline, can you hand out the What to Do with a Dead Buddhist card? So this, you can take two each if you want, one for your wallet and one for the fridge. So on one side is the What to Do with a Dead Buddhist, and on the other side are the great mantras printed very, very tiny. So I've got this in my wallet next to my blood type, so that if I'm hit by a bus, they're going to pull out the blood type and they're going to pull out the What to Do with a Dead Buddhist. But the other thing is that often when something like this happens, we go into shock, and you might forget how to say Om Mani Padme Hum. You might just forget everything because you're in shock. You can't access it. So that's why we've got on the back here actually the Medicine Buddha mantra. Tayata Om Bekanze Bekanze Maha Bekanze Radza Samogati Soha. A really powerful mantra to recite. And on the front is what to do if you come across someone who's died, step by step. And the main thing is to check, have they just died and they can be revived, or have they died several hours ago and now what do we do? And then the next thing is to slow down and breathe and describe the situation to yourself, and then call us. So there's the Long Reach Humper Centre phone number, and then there's my mobile. So that's what I'm here for. I'm for the life and death situations. Don't call me about should I bring in lunch for whatever or what so-and-so's email, because I will not answer and I will not answer the text. But if your pet is dying, or anyone in your family or friends are dying, that's when you call me. And it can be 3 a.m. You'll have to call three times because my phone's set on that thing to be quiet. So people, but if you call three times in a row, it'll ring. And so that's the time to not, don't think, oh, I don't want to be any bother. That's the exact reason why we're here. So that's why I'm giving my mobile number out, okay? Because it's not any bother at all. I've got my phone set so it doesn't, so people's texts don't come through before 8 a.m. in the morning because Queenslanders wake up so early. So that means, though, if you want to get through, you've got to ring three times, right? Even if it's just your hamster and you're really upset and you don't know what to do. There are also with this card, because of the 10 great mantras on the back, if you come across a dead possum on the road or somebody's dog, you can touch the body with these mantras. It's an incredible blessing. Whatever happens, try and leave the body undisturbed. That's good for both from a legal point of view, for the medicos, and from a Buddhist point of view. Even if the person might be in a funny kind of position, doesn't matter. We're over time, but I wanted you to have the proper emergency thing. We've covered a lot. How to contemplate death so that we can die without fear or regret. How we can recognize the process so that we don't panic, and how we can help ourselves and others. And really, it is the most profound thing that we can do for another human being is to help them. And that's what I found with my mother. I thought she brought me into this life, and the least that I could do after being a very worrisome errant daughter was to let her have a good death. And that was what was amazing that she did. She died without fear or regret. It's like it can prove to me it's possible. And we can all be the ones that can help in this situation. So start the arrangements for your will, folks. And have the talk with your family. Send them the link to Death Over Dinner. And we'll dedicate in a moment. Next week, we're looking at bodhicitta, which is this big altruistic attitude, big-heartedness, how to care for all beings, how to develop equanimity, how to even make sure that we care for people even if we don't like them, that general big-heartedness. Were there any last questions or comments before we dedicate our merits? Oh, yes. So that's so when you do have to move the body, like the ambulance people come or something, the last part that you want the consciousness to go to or be associated with the body is the crown of the head. So you pull the hair, kind of yank it as the last thing before they move the body. If the person's bald, then you can tap them on the head with a holy object. So I know a couple of nurses that do that, like in the hospital when people have died, then they will, just before they move the body out, so that the consciousness kind of goes whoosh upwards, because that then helps to have a good rebirth. Otherwise, you just have holy objects somewhere there at the bed head also. Okay, let's dedicate. So, how wonderful. We're still able to breathe in and breathe out. And we've made our time most meaningful by facing this difficult subject, difficult topic. Feel really good about having had the courage and put in the effort. And dedicate, may you continue to investigate, to know your own mind, to be able to be ready for your own death and for when those around you die, that you can help them not just have a good death, but also have a good rebirth, be able to die with a calm, happy, relaxed mind, and go happily and peaceful into the next rebirth. And from a Buddhist point of view, we dedicate all of this to the ultimate aim of being liberated from the cycle of suffering and uncontrolled rebirth, and dedicate for full liberation and enlightenment for oneself and all living beings. Okay, thank you very much, everybody. And congratulations. Especially all you first timers, oh my God. What an introduction!